troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine. All the worries gonna leave my troubled mind. I've got a broken thing.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast. I'm your co-host, Cameron English.
And I'm your other co-host, Kevin Folta, professor who cares about science and wants you to know more about what's happening in the headlines. How's that?
And we've got, it's beautiful. And speaking of headlines, we've got four important stories we're going to be talking about. Of course, most of them are related to coronavirus. And then we've got a new study discussing anti-GMO research that we're going to look at. But first up, can you catch COVID-19 twice? The answer is probably not, but the evidence is still coming in. So we're going to take a look at that. And on a related note, the virus isn't mutating very quickly, and at least for now. And that's very good news for vaccine developers. And then anti-biotech activists are saying that GMO crops are the source of the virus. So we're going to explain why that hypothesis is almost certainly nonsense. And then finally, we're going to take a look at some of the flawed studies, and even fraudulent in some cases, studies that are used to promote anti-GMO activism, and what researchers and what the public can do to try to quell the misinformation spread by this research. But Kevin, let's get into this first article. This is about a reinfection of COVID-19, and the study in question specifically looked at four monkeys. So I want to get into how significant this is to, you know, the general human population. So tell us a little bit about this work.
Well, this is an important question, right? When we're thinking about vaccines and we're thinking about how the herd will respond after we have this initial wave of infection, will people be suffering from more infection once they're released back to their, you know, homes? And once we start going back to work, will we just get it again? And really, that's the question. So what the study really wanted to sort out was, can we get infected twice? So once you've had it, does it behave like measles, you know, where, or, you know, chicken pox, where once you have it, you develop an innate immunity that now stays with you? Or is it something that you need to be re-vaccinated for on an annual basis, like influenza? And so the study's tiny, and it's not peer-reviewed. This was in bioarchives, so it wasn't accepted anywhere yet. But at the same time, the researchers were playing with what they had. And they had four rhesus monkeys, so four monkeys. And they were do you know how to tell if it's a rhesus monkey?
Is this a candy joke? Yeah.
It's got peanut butter on the inside. Yeah, when you cut it open. Anyway, but they had four rhesus monkeys. They studied their weight, their temperature, their everything about them. They did blood work, nasal and anal swabs, which, you know, you can imagine the undergraduate in that lab, you know, here, now's your time to shine, you know. So they did this first initial test, and then they infected those monkeys with coronavirus. And with SARS-CoV-2 coronavirus, the specific one that's causing all the trouble. And they let them get the infections. And then they euthanized one of them, and they described its post-mortem aspects. They did chest x-rays. They looked very carefully. They did CT scans. They saw some signatures like this bilateral ground glass opacities that are indicative of different types of lung distress. So they were able to really nail down that, okay, they did have an infection that was typical of what we would see in primates. So four monkeys, one dead, and it looks like they have the disease. So that's where they started.
So the first question that comes to my mind anytime I read animal research is, how applicable is this to human beings? So is this just a first step? And I know that we can talk about some other research in humans that's been done already. But as far as this study goes, how confident can we be that this is a legit finding?
Well, it's a limitation, right? I mean, every study has strengths and limitations. And this one, you know, it's hard to talk about strengths because there's so many limitations. Tiny sample size, primate model rather than humans themselves. But you know what? We're in a weird time where another data point isn't necessarily a bad thing. And, you know, we're, as they said, and as we've said, they're building the airplane as they're flying it. And so this study has some value. So they euthanize the one monkey, and they do the thing. So they have three left, and all of them had coronavirus or COVID-19 compatible infection in primates, in a rhesus monkey. They were down to three monkeys, so they gave two more another intratracheal dose of the virus, and then left one as a control. And the idea would be, how do they compare? So now you're comparing one monkey against two monkeys. And so over the next 5 days, they did nasal swabs and all the different ways you would screen for the virus, even the most sensitive tests. And they came out the same across all three. So you couldn't tell the control from those that were given the virus.
So we'll see. As you said, this hasn't been peer reviewed yet. So maybe after it's reviewed, we can be a little more confident. But there's been some other research done, as I mentioned, and they're both out of China. So one study was looking at people in what's the city called, Shenzhen, something. Yeah. I'm mispronouncing it. Whatever the case, though, they looked at people who had been infected, and then they found that 15% of 262 people were positive after being discharged, but they had no symptoms. And then there was another study out of Wuhan itself with four. Well, I guess this is just a case study, if you will, of four healthcare workers, but they tested positive for the infection after recovering, but they had no symptoms. So maybe these results suggest that, you know, you get it, and then you're not infected with it again, but there's still viral DNA in your system, and you're not showing symptoms, and you're not spreading it to other people. So maybe, you know, these results all taken together are encouraging. What do you think of that?
Well, that's the problem, is that there's so many other confounding variables that after you've had the infection, are you completely cleared of the infection? And that's the beauty of the detection methods. They're so sensitive. And, you know, we talked about with environmental working group, just because you detect it doesn't mean it's there and causing trouble. You know, in their case, pesticides. Just because you can detect it doesn't mean it's there and causing trouble. Same thing with virus. You can detect it, but it doesn't mean that you're in the heat of an infection and contagious situation. And I think that in the healthcare workers and in the other study in Shenzhen, it is a case where, sure, once you've had it, you can detect that you've had it. But it doesn't speak anything to that correlation of the viral load and where you have it with pathogenicity and mortality, morbidity, all that good stuff. So hard to say exactly what it means because we're still collecting data.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And one possibility I've heard some experts mention is that people recover from the symptoms, but they haven't fully cleared the virus. So they're technically still infected, and that's why they're showing up with these positive results. So it's not that they're catching it again, and that their immune system is failing again. It's just that they still have it and they just haven't fully cleared it. So that's something to keep in mind. But it just sounds like we're just not sure. As we've mentioned multiple times on this show, this is evolving in real time, and people are still, even the experts are still trying to put their thumb on what's happening.
Yeah, but that's the theme across all of the topics today, is that, you know, we're seeing data that are limited, and we have to at least draw a box around them to say, okay, this might be important, but here is as far as we can take it. We can't give it more credit than it's due. We can't overstep what we know. But at the same time, maybe there's something there. And so you just don't want to throw it out because it's a small, limited study. You want to say, here are some data, but we can only take them with a grain of salt. And I think that's the best take-home message from today's podcast.
Right. And speaking of a related story, as I mentioned earlier, the virus isn't mutating very quickly as of now, and that's a good sign. And so maybe that has something to do with why people aren't getting infected with it again. Like, your immune system's exposed to it, and then it knows what it's fighting. And so it's not as big of a threat, perhaps. But tell us a little bit about this article in the Washington Post. about the virus not mutating very quickly, Kevin, because this is a good development.
Yeah, this is actually a good thing. This was an article, as you mentioned, in the Washington Post by Joel Achenbach, and he described that the sequence analysis, when you look at the RNA sequence of the virus, it's an RNA virus rather than a DNA virus. When you look at the sequence, it across many different accessions, meaning if you get it from a person in, you know, China, a person in the States, different places in the States, the virus isn't changing much. And that there are some differences here and there, but it's not like influenza where there's changes all the time that allow it to evade detection. And that's good news, because when you look at the SARS-CoV-2 virus, you can see some very discrete changes that differentiate it from bats and pangolins. So bats were the presumed zoonotic transfer to humans, but also this thing called a pangolin, which is a kind of a scaled anteater, and the scales are used in traditional Chinese medicine. So these things together were the two major reservoirs, natural reservoirs for the virus. And when you look at the sequence, you know, line it up against each other, and there was a really nice paper in Nature Medicine that show that the SARS-CoV-2 mutations that really separate it from bats and pangolins in this human version are in a portion of the spike protein, so the part that interacts with the receptor on the human cells to begin the infection. And it could be part, and we don't know if it's, you know, exactly the part that makes it more infectious or contagious, but that's the part that differentiates it from bat and its other wild relatives.
Now, one thing that stuck out to me in this article is they said that the virus has a sort of proofreading machinery that basically keeps it from mutating too much. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think a lot of organisms have some kind of a proofreading system in place, right? Some kind of enzyme or system of enzymes that corrects mistakes in the DNA as the DNA is copied. And so is that what's happening here with the coronavirus?
Well, but keep in mind that this is an RNA virus, right? So when you make replication, you replicate using proofreading enzymes, and the enzyme, well, many of them have proofreading activity in your cells. The DNA polymerase that monitors that makes more DNA when you have cell division, one cell going to two. It has an inherent proofreading activity that double checks that as it made two copies, that the two copies were the same. But this is an RNA virus. DNA is double-stranded. RNA is single-stranded. So proofreading is a little bit different. You're not comparing it against another strand. You don't have anything to compare it to. So RNA viruses are inherently a little bit sloppier in how they synthesize DNA, which makes them a little bit more able to rapidly evolve around the barriers that are present, like zoonotic transfer. Going from animals to humans is a big jump, and going from person to person is a big jump. So it's the mutations that do occur, and the more rapid pace of RNA of errors in RNA viruses that makes them especially infectious.
So right now, as we said, it hasn't changed very much, and this is good. But if it continues to spread, it could accumulate the virus. I mean, it could accumulate more mutations and potentially become either less harmful or more harmful. So, you know, I don't know when we'll know that. Maybe it'll be, I don't know, 6 months, a year, something like that. Are you concerned at all looking at this as a geneticist that this thing is going to change, or is there just no way we can know?
Well, but this is the point, and this is a big part of the idea of stay at home, and the big idea of sequestering people away from each other is that if you somehow generate a mutation in the virus, say you're infected with this thing and you've generated lots of it, there's going to be a lot of that with errors and mistakes. Are those going to end with you, or are those going to move on to someone else? And that's really the question. And so the fact that there are errors, it's going to make errors. That's what viruses do. And they evolve very quickly. The question now is, will it make it from you to another person? And some of the ones that maybe make it especially dangerous you know, die in the hospital with a patient, or perhaps, you know, end in other ways. But the idea of isolation is such a strategic measure in ensuring that we're not passing something more lethal forward.
Now, one other thing that they mentioned in the article is that this idea that there are two strains of SARS-CoV-2 floating around, that hasn't been borne out by the data that we have so far, which is interesting because that was spreading for a while, that you had the original strain and then you had a slightly more deadly one that was floating around. But I guess that's not the case. Is that right?
Yeah, Kevin? I haven't seen a whole lot on this, actually. I've been following the story pretty close. Really, the big deal is the differences between the spike protein in the SARS-CoV-2 and the other related coronaviruses that are happening or that have that are present in bats, pangolins, in their natural reservoirs. I haven't seen much about the variation of the SARS-CoV-2 among human populations. But again, you know, we're still collecting data and it's so early and we're watching this unfold as it's happening, and very tricky times to be able to make any definitive statements.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll avoid doing that, of course. But I guess the big takeaway then is, assuming it doesn't change anymore or keeps changing at a slow rate like it is, that means that we could potentially develop a single vaccine for this thing, and then you get it and then you're immune for maybe many years or maybe for your entire life, which of course is a very big deal, because with the flu every season, as everybody knows, it mutates so rapidly that you have to get a new one every year. And you know, some years it's not very effective. Sometimes it's only, what, 30 or 40%. So hopefully with, you know, a single vaccine for this, it'll just go away. But, you know, who knows?
Well, that's an excellent point. And I think that's what really this whole thing has awoken us up to, is the fact that we need to be able to respond more quickly to a threat with a vaccine. And we talked a little bit about it previously with what's happening at Medicago and other companies that are able to manufacture vaccines and antibodies on very short time turnarounds. But now the question is, how do you test it fast and how do you deploy it fast and manufacture, you know, at scale? There's a lot of interesting things that will come out of this situation. So, you know, we'll put a big flag in this and say, let's come back to this in 10 years and talk about, you know, how it was way back when, right?
Right, right. Well, moving on to a slightly more crazy, I don't know if you can be slightly more crazy, but an odd hypothesis to say the least. Anti-GMO activist Vandana Shiva says that GMO soy used as animal feed in China was the original source of this new coronavirus. And I got to be honest, Kevin, I mean, I'm not a scientist, but I follow these issues closely, and her argument doesn't make much sense to me. So I'm hoping you can explain what she means. So she says that viruses used as promoters in GMO crops and viruses in our guts are hybridizing into quote unquote super viruses. And that's what, that's what SARS-CoV-2 is. So did I get that right? Is that what her argument is? To just start there.
Well, let's talk about where this started. This was at the Real Truth About Health Summit. And when someone tells you, when they call their conference, the Real Truth About Health, you kind of got to go, okay, some, you know, so everything else that medicine is telling me is false, and that I go to this summit and I'm going to listen to a few experts in quotes and they're going to tell me the truth. And the experts are Caitlin Shetterly, who's the one who came up with that script for, I can't remember the name of the movie now. It was absolutely horrible. I watched it and I really wanted to like it, but she believes that she became sensitized to GMO food and her kid did. It was Carrie Gillum, who was the author of Whitewash. Jeffrey Smith, the famous anti-GMO
dance instructor
who, you know, who goes after biotech advocates. And he FOIA'd me a few years ago and got like a billion pages of documents at public expense and never got anything out of it. But basically, and he's a big chemtrail guy too. And he believes that chemtrails are part of Monsanto's effort to control the world's food supply, even though there is no Monsanto anymore. But, you know, who cares about little details? All right. So this is the backdrop for the conference. It's Shiva and those folks at a panel. And after this panel convenes, she says, the new epidemics of viruses, a lot of scientists have said, are coming out from hybridization of viruses that are used as promoters and the viruses in our gut, which basically makes no sense to a scientist. But she's saying that there's this horizontal gene transfer thing that's happening, that GMO soy is lending genetic strength to new viruses. And, you know, to be honest, when I read this article, and it's by Miles Power, who I love. I mean, he does great work. I can't say enough about the guy. Shiva is smart enough to not come right out and say COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2 virus was caused by GMO crops. She will not say that directly. Don Huber might, but she won't. And then she backpedaled, but she gives this kind of careful pseudo language that her audience and the people who love what she's saying will make the connection. But then when you criticize it, her defenders will say, you know, there's folks online on Twitter who I read already who said, oh no, she never said that. You know what she means. This is at a conference early in 2020 where she says the new epidemics of new viruses. What is she talking about? She's talking about SARS-CoV-2. And so it's all this weird coded language. But the bottom line is she was saying that, you know, and while carefully knowing better, she's telling her audience and the people who follow her that it's the GM crops that are causing the virus.
Right. And we'll get more into the rhetoric that she's using and what she's implying, but I want to just debunk this idea really quick. And Miles went into this in his article, and basically the point is the viruses that she's talking about, because I believe she's talking about all of the coronaviruses, not just the most recent one. But Miles said, well, these viruses, or I think it was the original SARS he was talking about, but he said the virus came from bats originally. And so if you know anything about domesticated animals, bats are not domesticated. And so they're probably not eating a ton of GMO soy. And so on those grounds, her hypothesis doesn't make any sense. So just to get that out of the way, you know, it's already very convoluted and nonsensical at that juncture. But do you want to comment on that before I move on?
Well, you're pointing out details that make sense, which are not part of this particular conversation. So, yeah, I can't comment too much on that.
Okay, yeah, but just to get that out there, bats don't eat soy, as far as I know. So, you know, let's move on from that. But anyways, I've noticed one thing about a lot of conspiracy theories, including this one that she's proposing, and there's always some kind of an apocryphal story about an insider, whether it's, you know, a government scientist or a government official who, you know, discovered the truth, and now he's blowing the whistle on his former colleagues and on the entire system. And that was her thing too. She said 17 years ago, some scientist in China, and she doesn't name him, she doesn't say what his expertise is, but the scientist in China told her, you know, GMO crops are having this synergistic effect on other viruses. And so that's supposed to give it some kind of precedent. But I just don't understand, you know, like, why can't you tell us who it is, or why hasn't he written, or why hasn't she written anything about it? You know, it's always like this secret that we can never be in on, but it also is supposed to legitimize the stories she tells. And I always drove me nuts.
Well, yeah, but that is a hallmark of conspiracy crank claims, is that there's always somebody who, you know, some higher up in government. Years ago, I was at a conference where I heard someone talking about, you know, my friend has, he was on stage, this guy was on stage and said, I know somebody who has airtight evidence that climate change is an absolute hoax, and he can't come out and speak because he tried to publish a paper on it, but he was afraid because he, you know, and I said, well, tell you what, let me publish it and I'll put my name on it and I won't be afraid. And then when it gets accepted and blows the lid off climate change, we'll talk about the cabal that was holding it down. And you know what I mean? I would have the guts to do it, and if that was true. But it's always these weird shadowy figures that they can't talk about. And the bottom line is that it really is code for there's nothing here.
Right, right. And another thing that stuck out to me is that she said this conversation happened almost 2 decades ago. And maybe she's mentioned it at some point in the past, but it is awfully convenient that now that we're in the middle of a pandemic, she just has this insider information. You know? So if you had this in the early 2000s, wouldn't you have come out and said, hey, my colleague and I, we have this theory and here's the data to demonstrate it, or at least make you think it's a plausible hypothesis. But that doesn't happen. She just comes out with it after this pandemic breaks out, and it's in front of a sympathetic audience that probably doesn't have the credentials or even the skeptical mindset to question her on it. It's just like, how convenient.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. But it plays right into her game plan. And the idea of there's an international pandemic, it's causing people a lot of hurt and a lot of strain. So now it's her place to step into that and say, okay, here we are at this new pandemic, which really isn't a pandemic at all. It's a secret organization between the chemical industry, pharmaceuticals, and agriculture companies, and they are the ones who are perpetuating this, and that's who. So she plays right into that crazy mindset.
Yeah, and one other hallmark of the conspiracy mindset that she demonstrates is, it always goes back to big ag or big pharma or some big corporation is going to profit off of this at your expense. And that was what she comes back to, is that, they're making these dangerous crops, and in many cases, or in some cases, the biotech companies in agriculture are also the pharmaceutical companies. So Bayer would be a good example. And so she's saying, they're making these crops and they're having these negative side effects, but it's okay because, the pharmaceutical end of the business is going to profit now. But of course, in this case, that doesn't make sense because, as we've been discussing on the show, there is no confirmed treatment for this and there's not a vaccine yet. It's going to be a year and a half probably before we have one. And so what a stupid business model to put something out that's harmful that you don't have a solution to. So and Miles makes this point, it doesn't make sense from a business perspective. And if she had to explain that to anybody, her story would fall apart. But I just always find that fascinating. It always comes back to, big company X is trying to, pull one over on you.
Yeah. And big companies, well, let me put it this way. Dead people don't pay much. But at the same time, she's making good coin, traveling the world. And she is. I mean, she's been to California. She's been to Berkeley, Harvard. She's getting recognized by these student groups who say, we want to have Vandana Shiva here. And they bring her aboard. And, she gets big bucks per talk.
Yeah, it's like 40 grand.
I always remember it being 20 grand plus first class round trip from India, but whatever it is, it is. And, I can tell you what I get for most of the talks I do is pretty much, a donut and a coffee and thank you for coming. And yet they'll call me you're a shill for Monsanto, amazing that this is happening. But at the same time, the times we're in are strange, and we've shaken the snow globe. Things are going to settle very differently. And I think folks like Shiva and others who are in that conspiratorial mindset, there's a very good possibility that we may emerge from this with a little bit stronger respect for science. And I'd like to think that's true. And maybe her days are numbered with respect to her positions. And I think that folks like her and Smith, Sarah Laney, all the cranks who are out there, if they just came clean right now and said, you know what, we're going to put this aside. It's not that important compared to what we're going through. Food is more important. Technology is important. We're going to abandon this crusade. You would see people look at them as heroes. And, I'm kind of crossing my fingers that maybe this COVID-19 silver lining might be a reevaluation of the scientific positions of a lot of the people who fought against science.
Sure. Well, let's hope. I'm frankly not as optimistic as you are, given what we've seen so far. I'm seeing, not only are we seeing Vandana say this stuff about GMO soy, but, I've seen conspiracies about 5G being the source of the pandemic, and it's the same people that push the anti-GMO and the anti-vaccine stuff saying that. And
yeah, so, I know. Just wait till 6G. 6G and COVID 20. You heard it here first. It
sounds like a bad sci-fi movie. Yeah, it's just something you'd see on the sci-fi channel at 2 a.m. Gosh. Okay, well, speaking of cranks, since you mentioned that, Kevin, let's talk about this is an article by two people we both know. So this is Henry Miller and Kathleen Heffron writing in the journal GM Crops and Food. And they're breaking down this phenomenon of flawed and even sometimes just outright fraudulent studies that are published oftentimes in low quality or predatory journals, and sometimes even in really high impact journals. But these are studies alleging that there's problems with biotech crops. So give me your overall impression of this study or this article, because this is your wheelhouse.
Well, this is an article that, you know, I really wanted to write for a long time, and that is, whatever happened to, you know, when we look back in the rearview mirror, did these articles that people wrote that were against biotechnology that really shaped the landscape and even in some cases affected policy, did they change or how did they hold up when more researchers reevaluated the same question, or did the same researchers even repeat the same work? And when you look at what is out there, that many of these seminal papers that are consistently cited by anti-GMO folks, it shows that they don't hold up over time. And this particular paper discusses a few of these. There was a Critical Reviews in Food Science and Nutrition paper 2009 called The Health Risks of Genetically Modified Foods by Dona and Arvantinoyas. And you know, the claims they make didn't really hold up, and they omitted all the key references. Aris and LeBlanc, a very famous study about BT being in umbilical cords. You know, this one, when it came out, caused so many people to contact me, because now you're talking about pregnancy and innocent children and all this stuff. And they didn't talk about any of the important edges of that study. And so this was, I don't even remember when that was. That might have been 2008, 2009. Maybe 2012. But the bottom line is that that particular study, 2011, here we are in 2020, and there's been no follow-up. No one's demonstrated that there's more BT in umbilical cords and it affects fetuses or whatever. It died on the vine. And these one-off papers have been extremely dangerous because they shape public opinion. And really, what the best part about the paper by Heffron and Miller is that they provide some guidance about how scientists and how journals can maybe better protect against this kind of misinformation.
Yeah, and one thing I'll say as a science journalist, and this frustrates me to no end, is that these papers get promotion from the media either because the journalists covering it, they either don't understand the topic, or in many cases they're actually sympathetic to this sort of anti-GMO cause, as you well know, Kevin. And so, you know, I don't know if there's an answer for that. I think there's always going to be people writing clickbait headlines and trying to stir up controversy where it doesn't exist. So maybe the best thing to do is just to get the journal editors and the journals themselves and the scientific community to try to referee the situation better. There's no perfect answer, really, but if you can stop these from getting published, then there's not going to be any tweets about them. There's not going to be any CNN stories. And then maybe the problem will die down as time goes on through a strategy like that.
Yeah, it certainly is the issue. And when you look at, you know, again, maybe we go back to the idea that on the other side of this COVID thing, maybe we'll have a little different feeling about science and scientists and, you know, how we respect real research over this kind of sensationalist, very biased and even skewed research. And I think we might have something to really offer there. When I look at this, I don't see any better outcome than more scientists getting involved in debunking the claims. But as I've found out, that even when you step into this and say, let me explain to you the limitations of the study, it automatically targets you to the folks who are, you know, the authors and the activists around these studies. But then it also exposes you to other vulnerabilities. You know, your university doesn't want you to speak about it. Or people in the SciComm community, you know, get aggravated with you for speaking about whatever. It makes it very difficult for people who want to tell the truth and provide a cogent analysis to really want to step into that fray. And that's the problem. You know, these folks have an open ability to communicate it. Scientists, there's a lot of reasons to be reserved about stepping into it. And that's something that I hope sorts out at the other side of this whole COVID thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, I just thought of this, but I had an epidemiologist named Jeffrey Cabot on the show a while back. And one of the points he made was that the peer review process is actually pretty flawed these days. And he gave the examples of journals sending out articles to reviewers who aren't actually experts on the topic. And you know this better than I do, of course, but science is such a specialized profession that you may know your one topic really well, but you may not know something adjacent to it very well. And so maybe that's one of the issues, is that these articles are being reviewed by people that don't know what the problems are or what they should be looking out for. Is there anything to that, you think, in this case?
I agree 100%. You know, Jeffrey Cabot is right all the time about these kinds of things. And, you know, I want to differentiate peer review from beer review. and I really do think that there are cases. So as we have more and more journals and more places to publish papers, we are bombarded by opportunities to review them. And I probably get 3 or 4 invitations to review a paper a day. And a lot of them come from suspect journals. And I decline those. But somebody out there is accepting them. And they're papers that don't look terribly compelling. They're papers that make, you know, 'cause you read the abstract before you accept or decline. I decline because I don't want to spend the time to review something that I can see has inherent problems. It takes me 3 or 4 hours to review a paper properly. And I could either sit here and tear a paper apart and say, you know, here's why it's unfit to publish, or somebody else who maybe doesn't have much experience goes ahead and reviews it, gives it a favorable review. And so it's very challenging these days with all of the predatory publication, all of this, you know, so many different journals, hard to find reviewers. Bad stuff is being published. And that's why you have to look at 2 metrics. Does it make peer review? Maybe 3 metrics. Does the paper have reasonable impact? And the next one is it reproducible? Do other people see merit in the work, and have they followed up on the work? And good work grows. Bad work dies on the vine. And that's the take-home message.
Right, absolutely. By the way, I remember seeing, I think it was Allison Van Enenum posted an invitation email she got from one of these journals, and she could tell the research was bad, as you said, but you know, the invitation letter itself was so poorly written. She was like, this can't be real. You know, it's like, hello, Allison, you like review paper for our journal, groundbreaking article on whatever the topic was, you know, but it was clearly written by someone using Google Translate who doesn't speak English. Probably a telltale sign that it's not a good.
Yeah. Channel, right? I always get them that say greetings of the day. And then they have, it's pretty funny. They say greetings of the day and they'll say, we do so much like you too. And then a different font, Dr. Folta. And the best part is, and maybe we could talk about this someday. If you Google the phone numbers or the address of the publishing house, you find that they're in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., and it's an apartment building, or maybe a storage shed in Georgia, or maybe in an empty lot somewhere out behind a football field in suburban Chicago. I mean, I'm not kidding. I mean, these are on a website that I started a while ago. And it's amazing that these are considered potential places to publish work. And that plays into this very strongly.
Yeah. It sounds like it's just one step above these scams that people get in their email about a Nigerian prince giving them $10 million as long as they send $30,000 first or whatever. You know, this is ridiculous. Anyways, all right, Kevin, well, let's wrap it up there. I think this is has been a helpful episode, if I humbly can say so myself. But give people your Twitter handle, give them your website, and your Facebook project that you've been working on
as well. Yeah, cool. I'm at Kevin Folta on Twitter. It's the Talking Biotech podcast every week. And then right now, while we're locked up in COVID-19 land, I'm doing a daily visit with kids at 11 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And we're talking about a different science topic every day at 11. And man, it's a lot of work to put together a lesson for every day at 11. But we're doing topics. Today we did, are dinosaurs and birds related? We talked about bird development and chickens on the farm. And next week, we're going to talk about the constellation Orion and many different things across science. And I try to gear it through grades 1 through 6. It's on my personal, on my professional Facebook page at facebook.com/KM, like Mary, Folta. And hope to see you there.
Right on. Well, everybody check that out. And as always, you can get this podcast at geneticliteracyproject.org. We are at Genetic Literacy on Twitter. I am at Cam J. English. And we will see you guys next week. Thank you so much for tuning in.